My guest is film director Robert Altman. He had his first hit in 1970 with the film MASH. The spontaneity and risk-taking MASH was praised for became Altman's trademarks in his subsequent films such as McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Nashville, and Three Women. Altman's recent films have bombed at the box office, but now he's having success on TV and cable. He directed the remake of The Caine Mutiny, which was recently broadcast on network TV. And for HBO, he's directing the Tanner 88 series, written by Gary Trudeau, the creator of Doonesbury. Tanner 88 stars Michael Murphy as a former congressman named Jack Tanner, who is a late entry into the Democratic presidential primaries. Tanner 88 is shot documentary style on the campaign trail. In fact, Murphy has run into a couple of the real candidates who have ended up doing cameos on the series. Several other politicians and advisors have played themselves in episodes of Tanner. Altman describes this comedy as a chance to show through fiction the inner workings of a political campaign and how dependent the candidates have become on campaign directors and media directors. In the opening scene of the series, Jack Tanner was interviewed on a New Hampshire TV program before a studio audience.
Who is Jack Tanner and where did he come from? Good morning, Mr. Tanner.
Good morning, Jack. Nice to meet you.
Where did you come from?
East Lansing, Michigan. And Warm Springs, Georgia.
San Antonio, Texas. And how about Walla Walla, Washington? Riverside, California. And
Pearl Harbor?
Well, let's not forget Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. You know, I was born in Pearl Harbor.
You know, I have to say, Jack, you sound like George Bush a little bit, the vice president. It's hard to know what state he's from.
Well, that's true, but I actually lived in all these states. I was an Air Force dependent, and as you know, when you're an Air Force dependent, you move around a lot.
Robert Altman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm fresh air I need.
It seems that in a lot of your work, you've wanted to incorporate some of the unpredictability of life into your films. Now, following a fictional candidate down a real campaign trail seems like a perfect way of doing that.
It's the most fun I've ever had in anything I've done. It's the closest to the kind of things I've been edging up to or trying to get people to do, because we're really dealing with a sense of truth, not facts, but truth.
Well, politics has become such a media event. You're traveling with Michael Murphy as Tanner down the campaign trail with, of course, a complete media setup because everything you're doing has to be shot. Is your media setup much different than the ones that are following all the real candidates?
Yeah, we're a little more sophisticated than that, and we it's closer to you know, our lighting's a little more, our scheduling is rather exact. What we do is that we create an event and we in an arena, and then we have prepared, and then we just document that event. Sometimes we're in a real situation where Tanner and his campaign, the other actors, are dealing, crossing through with an existing situation, and we don't really know what's going to happen, what the text is going to be. It's a lot of found art, and then a lot of it are very structured scenes that Gary Trudeau writes. I mean, they're written. The scripts are, I would say, two-thirds scripted and two-thirds found art.
That's four-thirds, but we'll let you get away with that because you're Robert Altman. I'm interested in the third or the two-thirds that's found art. What are some of the most interesting parts of the found art that have happened?
Well, for instance, when we first started and we were in New Hampshire, we would just hear that Bob Dole was someplace or Jack Kemp was in some area, and we would just take our camera crew and Tanner and his daughter, or Michael Murphy and Cynthia Nixon, or whoever happened, whatever actors we had there, and we would just go and encounter them. We didn't surprise them. We would talk to their, their advisors and campaign people on the streets, and we would just say, be sure that Dole knows his name is Jack Tanner, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and whack, they'd go up and shake hands and talk. That's why we started with that. Then we I guess the culmination of that was the show in Washington, the second show we did in Washington, where Bruce Babbitt shows up, and he and Tanner take a walk by the tidal basin, and there's about a 7-minute, 8-minute conversation between the two of them. And
I just happened to have a clip of that standing by, of that conversation between Babbitt and Michael Murphy, and I thought I'd play an excerpt of that and then find out what it was like to direct Bruce Babbitt playing himself. Well, but this is, let's listen to the some of the scene first. And this is Bruce Babbitt offering his advice to the fictional Jack Tanner, who's running for president.
So you got a chance now. People know you.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a chance now to take the next step, to say, okay, I'm going to take some risks. Talk honestly. Try to make it work. Now, it may not. I mean, yeah. God knows I'm living testament to that. I mean, you can walk out there, look people in the eye and say, okay, I'm going to talk to you straight about our future and how it is Americans have to get together and start solving problems rather than living in this kind of, you know, silver screen stage of unreality.
Was that written for Babbitt, or did
he make that up himself? No, he was. When we first talked to Governor Babbitt, we told him what we wanted to do, and he had seen other shows, and we showed him all the previous shows, and he talked to people we dealt with, and everybody feels very comfortable with us, apparently. So then he said, okay, he'd do it. Then they called, his people called back and said, what are you wanting to talk about? And I said, I don't care. I don't have the slightest interest. I have interest in what he talks about, but I have not the slightest interest in guiding that in any way. So I just refused to deal with that. I said, you can talk about Russia, you can talk about Reagan, you can talk about the press, you can talk about anything. And so that's was entirely his conversation with Tanner.
Did you give him any directions?
Nope.
So it's not hard to direct someone to be themselves. You just tell them to be
themselves.
Well, they were just
out there walking, and, uh-huh. and we were wheeling ourselves along in front of them with a camera.
Now, one of the scenes in Tanner was shot outside of the South African embassy, where there are constant ongoing demonstrations against apartheid. Were those real demonstrators out there when you shot that scene?
There was a large demonstration on sometime in April, and we went down there with Michael Murphy, Jack Tanner, and Cynthia Nixon, and one of our Secret Service men, and one of our reporters, and we hired a crew, a news crew down there, and we shot them in that actual South African demonstration where people got arrested, etc. And Lowell Weicker was there, Senator Weicker, and all of the people, and there were speeches, and we filmed that. And then when we went back to Washington to do our show about 2 weeks later, we went back to the same locale, the same exact same place. We set up our own demonstration. We got the signs and the material from the people who had staged the first one, and we restaged it with a smaller crowd and shot just tighter. And we integrated that film back and forth. But it's hard to tell which was the real and which was not, because it doesn't make any difference.
Are there details that you wanted to get in to Tanner 88 to make it look as real, as lifelike as possible?
Well, I think it's the opposite. We want that, of course. That's what everybody achieves, is to fool the viewer so they think, is this real, isn't this real? But on the other hand, I think it's very important that we constantly let people know, not fool people, that we let them know that this is staged or scripted, or it's a combination, and I think it's very important that we keep that combination. We have people, a lot of our own people, will staff will say, "Oh, we think Tanner should do this and this kind of politics." I don't care what his politics are. I'm not trying to express my own political feelings. What I'm trying to do, what Gary Trudeau and I are trying to do, is to use Tanner as a cipher of to show people what, if he goes through this, and this seems real, probably the other candidates too. So we're not trying to put up what we think is a perfect candidate. I mean, we make a fool out of, or he makes a fool out of himself, I should say, every episode. He slips or falls or makes some mistake. And we're not interested. We don't want to get him elected.
Nevertheless, do you feel like you're actually with a candidate who's running for office?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because Michael says, I don't want to say that. That makes me sound stupid. And I said, well, then say something that doesn't make you sound stupid. And, of course, he can't think of anything.
That's the most lifelike part for a
politician. Yeah, so he's exactly, you know, because these guys, they can't talk about these issues on the total sides of them. They have to talk about it in capsule form that fits this media. This is a very leisurely media, this radio. This is kind of fun.
So you can become a campaign manager when all this is
that's
over.
That's exact. That, well, no, I won't do that. But that's the role that I suppose that I come the closest to. We go to Detroit. Actually, tomorrow people start going, and we shoot in Michigan the next episodes. And we go up there, and we have our script, and we know what we're going to do within the personal complications and plots within our staff and Tanner. But we don't know what we're going to find up there in terms of what is actually going on currently in this political race until we get there.
My guest is film director Robert Altman, and he directs the Tanner 88 series on HBO. He also directed the recent television remake of The Caine Mutiny, and his movies include MASH, Nashville, Three Women, The Long Goodbye, and Fool for Love. Now, the Caine Mutiny remake that you just did was for television. It's interesting, you know, Tanner's for TV, Caine Mutiny was for TV. You started your career in television before you even got into movies, and you left that, and I think you were really glad that you did. You directed Combat, Bonanza, The Roaring Twenties, Suspense Theater. I've read that you used to get fired a lot when you were working in television.
Well, everybody,
did you break a lot of the rules?
Well, I broke a lot of their rules, I guess. I don't know. I got replaced a lot, I think.
That's the word for it, huh?
Yeah. Or terminated. But at television, when I started in the 60s and the late 50s, everybody was trying to get into the feature film business because that was the class, that was the quality. And television was a stepping stone. And although I spent a lot. I did many, many, many hours of television. Then when I got into features, it's a matter of allocating your time. I just didn't do any television for a while. But now I think it's more interesting, especially with cable. Most of these things that you're talking about, the Tanner, of course, is on cable.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have censorship restrictions. We don't have. I don't have to worry about having a show on every half hour every week. I don't have to worry that the half hour has commercial breaks and where they come. There are no commercial breaks. The show is roughly a half hour. Sometimes it's 28 minutes. Sometimes it's 31 minutes. They don't care. So it's about every 2 weeks that we go on the air. So it's very leisurely, and of course, ultimately, I think the biggest market for this will be, for Tanner, will be in the cassette market.
Mm-hmm. When you started doing television, what were some of the things that you used to do that would get you into trouble?
Well, I'd have actors talk at the same time. And
like in real life?
Yeah, and we would just, there were lots of restrictions, and people had ideas that I didn't get fired all that much. I was kind of successful, as a matter of fact, in television.
One of your, well, I think your first really big hit was MASH. Now, from what I understand, 14 directors turned it down, and then you accepted. Is that right?
Well, I suppose that's right. There were, you know, it was a cheap little script, and nobody thought very much of it. And, you know, none of the serious big-money directors wanted to do it. And I read Ring Lardner's script, screenplay. I read the book also. There was a little novel, which was just terrible. But the script had something in it that was very interesting to me, and I agreed to do it.
What was it that was so interesting?
It had to do with the truth about the Vietnam War, or about an Asian war, as I should say, and of what goes on and the attitudes and you know, it wasn't about heroes and winning and killing the enemy. It was about, you know, the only gunshot in it was at the halftime in a football game, and yet we made these operations and the pain and really real. And tried to make, my idea was to that every for every laugh, and it was outrageous. By that I mean nothing was sacred. The cheaper, the more base the joke was, the better. But for every laugh the audience had, they had to pay a little bit for it.
Pay with?
With ooh, wait a minute. There's somebody really being damaged out there. There's somebody mm-hmm. really being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not to be continued. It was a film that in the end said, this is just a movie, the real thing is worse than that. And it became a series after that, which I had nothing to do with, and I didn't approve and don't approve of that series, because that was strictly a commercial venture. And what it did is, for 12 years... it said there's an Asian war in your living room every night, and no matter what platitudes they said in those scripts, or little niceties, it still said that they were the bad guys and we're the good guys. And I just think it was very bad propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it wasn't what we had in mind, and it wasn't what the film was about.
Okay. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work as a director, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is director Robert Altman, who's done many movies, including MASH and Nashville, The Long Goodbye, Fool for Love. He's directing the Tanner 88 series on HBO, and also just directed for network television the remake of The Caine Mutiny. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Director Robert Altman is my guest. Your early films gave you the reputation, films like MASH and Nashville, of being a director who likes to have the actors improvise a lot while the film is being shot. Do you think of yourself as that kind of director who goes after improvisation?
Well, we go after the illusion of improvisation, or the illusion of truth. These things are always rehearsed. Any improvisation that's done on any of the projects I've ever been involved with, whether it's theater or film or television, it's always in the rehearsal stage, and we arrive at something. It's very much the way that we're doing the Tanner things now. I mean, the improvisation is necessary because I'm not going to sit there and have a script for people like Bruce Babbitt or real people. So that is true improvisation for the actors.
Why do you like that? Why are you interested in that?
Well, I just think it's a different kind of theater. It's it gives the audience, the illusion of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to give them reality. We're not trying to give them facts. We're trying to give them truth and the illusion of reality.
Now, as a director, what kind of preparation do you have to do with actors that you're working with to get that kind of illusion, so that they can work within the structure and have it look improvised, or improvise within that structure?
Well, they do all the work. They're the artists. I don't do much of anything. In fact, I do my very best to talk as little as possible to actors about what it is they're doing. I mean, I try to give them ideas. let them see what I give them options, but they have to come up with these characters. If I did any film, any piece of work I've ever done, if it all happened exactly as I wanted it to happen in my mind before, it'd be really terrible. But these people, these actors come in, they become these characters, and they fill out the whole life of them. And they bring things into me that I've never seen before or thought of or dreamed of. And I'm sitting here watching this unfold. It's like doing a mural with where the paint, the pigment, the paint is living. So I put the green up on the canvas, and it has its own life, and it moves toward the yellow, and it moves away from the red, and all this. I put it in certain places, but it forms its own. The picture becomes that.
I think of you as being the opposite of a method actor's director.
I don't know what that is. A method act. I mean, that's an acting system, I guess, that many actors use, that I deal with, and many don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's the same thing, really. The actor's going into their own sense memories and sources to bring forth behavior and behavioral patterns.
Earlier when we were talking about television, you said that one of the things you wanted to do in your early television career was have overlapping dialogue, have two characters talking simultaneously, or three or four, like what happens in an actual room of people where you're overhearing several conversations at the same time. It's another thing that you've become very well known for in the film industry. Did you feel when you started directing that it was very stilted to have one person saying their lines and then pausing and then the other person saying their lines?
Well, and I think in most cases it is. But, you know, I saw the early films of Howard Hawks and people like that, and overlapping dialogue was used all the time. A lot of screenwriters don't like it because they have this planned in a certain way, but they're wrong in some cases. And I've done whole films where people, there's not an overlap line in it, because that's the way the behavior would be. But in most cases, I don't think people listen to other people. I mean, as soon as they start talking, the other person knows what they're going to say, and they're thinking of their response right away. And we try to get that. I just try to have that same feeling, so an audience gets a feeling, not anything specific.
Have you had to figure out how much the ear can follow?
Well, you can't. You can sit in a restaurant because you have two ears, and you can actually, your brain can direct, you can isolate, you can actually zoom in, iris in on a table and close out other voices. You can do that. It's very hard to do that in the film, or we have the same dimension. We have two dimensions on what you see in film and television, and your hearing's the same way. So again, we have to give the illusion of you being able to make that selection. You can't actually make it. In a stereo situation, it's possible for you to do it. But with your eyes glued on one object, it's difficult. So again, we have to do a little, it's the illusion of it.
Robert Altman is my guest, and he's now directing the Tanner 88 series for HBO, and he's directed many movies, including MASH and Nashville and Fool for Love. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you gave Cher, Lily Tomlin, and Robin Williams their first acting roles.
Well, not their first acting roles.
The first film roles.
If they've done something else, in each case, I never had any questions, or it never entered my mind that they wouldn't be just wonderful. They're the ones that, again, have to do the work. And Cher, when I ran into her, and she said, "I want to be a serious actress," and I said, "Well, good, come and be serious. I've got a play you want to read for it." And she said, "Yes," and so I put her in the play.
You had a period of a few years where none of your films were really making it commercially. Films like Health and Quintet, A Wedding. Even Fool for Love, which I think got a lot of critical praise, never really made it commercially. Do you want to go back into movies now, or do you feel like you've...
Well, I don't... That's all a marketing. You mean they weren't... They didn't suit the market. Those films were, to me, highly successful films.
Mm-hmm.
A Wedding is one of the quintet. Those are all... I mean, I don't... I have very few films that I... that we didn't achieve what we set out to do. If we didn't achieve what the people who sell them set out to do, that really is their problem. The problem with making films now, I've got lots of films I'd like to make, but I don't think anybody's going to give me the money to make them because I don't think I can or will make the films that they want to make that serve this existing market. You make a film now, it has to go, the movie houses are, the cinemas are very hard to get into. Look at Bertolucci's film, The Last Emperor, won 9 Academy Awards, and it can't get a decent theater in any city in the country because they're all playing Beetlejuice and Fatal Jump Jump or whatever the, you know, all this trash is. It seems to me that art is something that you should do, and people should come and find its way to it. And you can't, what audiences really want to see is something they've never seen before. And these people now are marketing, of course, just reruns of stuff they have seen. So movies don't really interest me right now.
So for the time being, you feel you have more freedom in television and cable?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for the fresh air.
My guest has been film director Robert Altman, and he's currently directing Tanner 88. HBO will present a 3-hour block of all the Tanner segments that have already been produced on Saturday, June 4th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.